Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk. G'day, Ben.
G'day, Tim.
Ben, take a listen to this.
Hey man, a lot of guys your age are learning to surf.
It's cool. There's nothing wrong with it.
I'm 25.
But I'm saying it's never too late. Hope you stick with it. Surfing's the source. It'll change your life. Swear to God.
Now, naturally, we all know that that was a soundbite from the movie Point Break. Easily recognizable. Surfing's the source. But what, Ben, if surfing wasn't the source? What if the source was something deeper that started with deconstructing your ego? Now, we've all made mistakes, maybe even bad mistakes. Well, this is a story of a young boy who made a chronic mistake. He was completely off the rails with an absence of role models, but he was surrounded by an abundance of evil. From the lowest of very lows, Greg Wallace turned his life from being distracted by these true and complete evils to now inspiring people as part of a community to be their very best. And he does this through the process of building the most beautiful wooden surfboards. Surfboards that are absolutely customized to the builder, but the builders soon realize that the board, while important, is only one part of this journey. Now, don't worry, Ben, you'll still get to surf and you'll surf happier and more fulfilled. This is more than just a surfboard. Let's get on with the show.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. Now, Tim, we're recording this from a very different location this week. Where are we?
We are in Bodie Tree Surfboards on the shop floor, surrounded by wooden surfboards in varying stages of construction.
These things, and we'll get a lot more detail on exactly the story behind these, but they're more than just surfboards. These are works of art. It feels like an artist's studio as much as a sort of functional workshop.
Yeah, and maybe we should paint a little bit of the picture. So we're in an old warehouse, used to be a
bakery,
and it's broken up into a couple of levels, but fundamentally on the bottom level, there's old pieces of tree, massive big,
timber.
What's the word I'm looking for? Timber, yeah, yep. One of those. And then out the back, some machining where we're cutting that timber down into usable strips, and then a location where we're refining surfboards and building them. Now, none of that terminology will be correct, but there is someone here who knows absolutely how to build a surfboard and why it is more than just a surfboard.
Yeah, we're absolutely thrilled to be joined by Greg Wallace here today. Greg is the founder and the driving force behind Bodie Tree Surfboards. Greg, g'day.
Hey guys, how are you?
Thanks for being here. No, thanks for having us. This is an absolute treat, and we'll talk a lot more about the process and about the studio that we're in at the moment. But maybe we could start, Greg, by just getting a bit of background on yourself, a bit of your story and how you got to where you are today.
Okie dokie. So I left school when I was 15 and I was a jeweller for 3 years, or I was a pretend jeweller. I didn't realise that until 3 years in. From there, I went and worked at an advertising agency in the city and then managed a surf shop when I was 21. In that time, I was starting to understand myself, and I suppose circumstances led me down a wrong path, so I got hooked up in hard drugs and hanging out with bad crew and things like that. I had a detective knock on my door one day when I was about 21 and say, "Is your name Mr. Gregory Wallace?" And I was like, "Yes, it is." And I saw my life flash before my eyes and thought, I'll either be dead or go to jail within a few years if I don't change my ways. I went to work the next week and a friend came in and said he was studying natural medicine. And I was like, wow, you can do that? And I rang my dad and said, this is what I want to do. And he was like, well, if you loosely put, if you fuck this up, that's it. And I was like, no, it's what I want to do. I'm going to make that my career. The next week I went to work and there was chains around the door. So the business had been sent bankrupt by the owners. And that was my life. So I shifted away from, like I say, doing hard drugs and went and stayed at a mate's place and started studying and spent 15 years as a naturopath. For the first couple of years, I used to take turns with a mate sleeping under the desk down the back corner. Mm-hmm. So one of us would take notes and the other would sleep. And he died in a car crash on the first day of the year on my third year. So I went from sitting down the back to sitting up the front. And it was really that if I have an ability to sell things and I have an ability to understand things, then I'm going to use this to help people. So I knuckled down and like I say, spent 15 years as a naturopath lecturing and practicing and doing volunteer work in hospitals and working a lot with end-stage disease.
Can we talk about the end-stage disease? What was your role in that?
It happened by chance. It was never a planned thing. I was just asked to go and talk to people when they were facing terminal illnesses. So to basically spend time with them in hospitals and even not necessarily counsel them, but just to be there for them. I was pretty heavily into energetic medicine, so things like Reiki and pranic healing and hands-on healing. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a fascination for me in terms of healing and quantum physics, how they tie together. And it just happened that I would get calls out of the blue from people I didn't know, and they were just told that I was the person to go and talk to them. So
these were people who were diagnosed with a terminal illness.
Yep.
And you were with them through the journey until they died.
Yeah.
And you've previously told us that it was a job you really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Can you explain how you can enjoy being a part of that process?
I think it's because it is part of a process. You know, it's a part of life. Like it's not an unusual part of life. It's super usual.
Yeah.
But it's
kind of compulsory.
It's kind of compulsory. Yeah. But it's put on the back shelf for most people in that they never face it and they never talk about it.
It's almost a taboo in Western societies in a way that it isn't in some other, particularly Eastern cultures.
Very much so. And part of my belief system that grew out of studying and reading and things like that was looking at Buddhism, where the most important part of life is the moment you die. You know, the all Buddhist practice is leading to a single moment that if you leave this life in peace, you're said to enter the next life in peace. Where in our day and age, most people leave in fear or in regret or in material, you know, plentitude and wanting instead of needing and knowing themselves.
Mm. So, did you draw fulfillment from that role that you had, the critical role in being part of the final stages of someone's life?
Yeah, it was something that was private. You know, I didn't tell people about it. It wasn't anybody's business but myself and that person. I suppose there was an inner fulfillment because it was real. It wasn't the fluff. You know, I don't think I've ever really fitted in because I've never really understood footy and sport. And I think from a young age, I realized I was never going to be good at anything. So I wanted to be good at being a person. So the inner journey for me was more exciting than the outer journey. You know, it was like, well, the outer journey is just so repetitious.
Yeah.
And so what's the catch? But the inner journey is just, who knows where that goes, you know?
Mm.
And in the philosophies of Carlos Castaneda, which he said that he's either a kook or he was a real dude, but he was an anthropologist in the 60s and got tricked into becoming a shaman's apprentice. And then he talked a lot about using death as your advisor. So basically looking at your death and saying, well, if today is my last day, how will I act impeccably? You know, what's the best way that I can be?
And what was the trigger for that piece of work to be your last day to move into the next stage of your life?
Into Bodhi Tree? I was practicing my practicing in natural medicine and lecturing. I had just run 6 weight loss and wellness clinics, and so I'd open and run and then close down those due to a contractual agreement. And I started working at a company doing motivational speaking and health courses, and I was writing courses and stuff like that. And a mate called me up one day and he goes, I'm going to build a wooden surfboard. And I was like, well, put my name down, you know. And he goes, well, it's not, we don't know if it's going to happen, but we're the guy's collecting names. And I was like, well, put me on the list. And it wasn't till, it was a 6-day course, and it wasn't until the last day when I literally stepped across the threshold to leave, and it was like, holy shit, I've just felt passion. It was just like an overwhelming, oh my God, that's what it is. You know, I was 37, had a 3-month-old little boy, and it was just, oh my God. And then I thought, I reckon I could do that. You know, I reckon I'd be pretty good at it. And then the next thought was, holy shit, what if I get to the end of my life and think I didn't do it? The one thing that gave me that buzz, and I didn't chase it down. And I was like, I'm never going to let it happen.
So you left the job that paid you well.
Yep.
And you went to the job that wasn't going to initially pay you much, if anything.
I got a job at Bunnings. So I went from having fairly good credentials, I suppose, to being a shelf monkey, which was incredible because it was so good to break apart the remnants of the ego, you know, that you go into Bunnings and you're a nobody, yet the people that were there were genetic scientists, and it's crazy the people that work at Bunnings, mm-hmm. the depth of their knowledge and understanding, but it was just a great understanding of how to serve.
So, Greg, you've spoken about, I guess, these two sliding door sort of moments in your life, one when you were 21 and the detective knocks on the door, the other when you step across the threshold having made your first wooden surfboard. Lots of people get these and, you know, either ignore them, maybe don't have the courage to pursue what they think or know is right. What do you reckon makes you different in terms of the way you think and the way you approach these things that you would turn initially your life around at age 21 and then follow a passion at age 37, which is an extremely courageous thing to do?
I don't think there's anything different. I think it's just a choice. Like, I think it's probably more philosophical than anything. Mm. I think I spoke to you guys a little bit when we first spoke about Joseph Campbell and his philosophies of follow your bliss. I don't know.
What about it that the one with the detective? I mean, it must have been a very difficult cycle to break. You know, a lot of your mates, I assume, were into sort of drugs and a life less legal. How did you make that change towards the path you knew was right?
It was in reflection. So through Castaneda, he talks about deconstruction of the ego. Mm-hmm. So it was a recognition that when I was a jeweler, people think they're better than other people by what they wear on their fingers, and we were dealing with bikies and all sorts of people, and it was literally how much gold you wear and how big your diamond was, you're a better person. And it was like, well, that's not true. Mm. So then I worked in Perth's biggest advertising agency, and it was like, okay, well, these are these suits tricking people into believing things that aren't true to make them buy stuff that they don't really need to make them feel better. And then in the surf shop, it was about, well, if you don't wear these clothes and do these things, you don't fit in. I don't know. And then just philosophy of natural medicine. You know, got stuck into Rudolf Steiner and H.P. Blavatsky and theosophy and things like that. And
yeah. I'm just thinking as you're saying this, Tim can do the show notes for this episode because there's a lot to get in terms of the references that we'll put to this. But, I mean, it sounds like... I mean, how did you get exposed to all of these different schools of thought and ways of thinking? Did you pursue that yourself, or did you have someone influential in your life?
No. If anything, it was probably the opposite.
And we're happy to skip over if there's...
No, to me, I think it's important. It's just hard to talk about. Um, Not that it's hard to talk about, I just don't want to sound like a crybaby. When I was 15, I was standing in the middle of a paddock with a gun in my gob. And just thought the world would be a better place without me.
So, upstairs when we were taking a walk around, you pointed to a bookshelf. The bookshelf is full of books. And you said, if you want to understand me, that's how to do it. What's on that bookshelf?
So, when I was standing in the middle of the paddock with a gun in my gob, I had my finger on the trigger. It was a 22 rifle, and I was 15, so I used to walk out the door on my uncle's farm with a box of bullets in the morning and come home at sunset. And life was just the way it was, and I didn't feel like I fitted in, didn't understand myself. Had my finger on the trigger and heard this voice. And the voice basically said, it's not your time. It's time for you to start reading and understand there's different ways to live a life. Your parents did the best they could with the knowledge they had. It's time for you to start reading.
Had you read before that moment?
Sorry, guys. So I was going to a special school outside of school so I could learn to read and write when I was 15. I knew how to do it, but I just didn't fit in. I didn't fit into the boxes. So that was it. I just started reading. You know, it was, I think the first book that I read was called The Leviathan, which was about a tanker. And then when I was 19, I was running this surf shop, tripping every weekend and doing mushies and shooting up speed. And, I was living with seven girls in a house and a guy that I sponsored, and we used to skate through the house and all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, what you do when you're a kid. And one of these girls was a backpacker, and she had a Carlos Castaneda book. And it was like, oh my God, this is fascinating. You know, this is a different way to live a life. And a girlfriend at the time, her mum was into what we'd term these days as woo-woo stuff. And she gave me Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Yeah.
And that was it. So on the bookshelf is, I mean, there's a lot of academic books and a lot of books on martial arts and surfing, but the top shelf is all on, I suppose, turn of the century spirituality. So from late 1800s to 1950s, where that spiritualism movement was founded, I suppose, and like I say, the Theosophical Society and Rosicrucianism and that search inside, Alice A. Bailey and...
So let's talk about spirituality. In many ways, I think a lot of people associate it with religion. I think it's a very different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally find my spirituality through art, and I think this is very much what is the crux of Bodhi Tree.
Yep.
Can you talk to the journey? We've walked in the doors here. Tim explained the layout. But for a surfboard maker, what's their journey into Bodhi Tree and the process between sort of walking in the door and walking out with a completed surfboard?
I suppose the truth of Bodhi Tree is that Bodhi Tree is a bludge. You know, I figured out that I love making surfboards, and I had to figure out how I could monetize it. And I figured that if I built surfboards for a living for other people, I'd get bored. So the only way I could figure to do it was to share it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've created a space that is safe for me. So like I say, we're in a bit of a compound. That this safe is placed for me energetically. We don't listen to the news. I don't know what's going on in the outside world. So for me, what I've done is created a space where people can just be themselves. So when they walk in the door, They choose what sort of board they build. Mm-hmm. It's a two-week process where I get the frame ready and the timber and stuff like that. And then when they come in, I work on a theory of implied ability, is that everybody has the same skills. You know what to do. It's your mind that will tell you you don't. So I set people to task and I walk away. I'll always keep an eye on them. I know what's happening from one end of the building to the other by hearing it. Mm-hmm. I know when somebody's filing in the wrong place or sanding in the wrong place or machining in the wrong place, I can hear it. And I'll always be watching, but it's from a distance, you know, so.
And what about that aspect? And we've spoken previously about, it seems to be increasingly lost in modern society, but the aspect of creating something, particularly something beautiful, with your hands, that very tactile component, and linking back to our discussion on spirituality, do you think that's something that is missing broadly in society at the moment, and that there's a place for that?
I think probably the thing that ties it all together is knowing yourself. You know, the old on the door at the Temple of Delphi is know thyself. And I think that that's all these things do. You know, I was thinking about identity and stuff like that, because people identify themselves with their jobs or their positions or their roles, but you take that away and they're lost. And obviously that's what I see here with ex-service personnel and first responders, is because they've been in such a tight-knit community for so long and identified with that, when that's taken away, there's a loss of identity.
Yep.
And the identity is created from the outside, not the inside. And that's the big difference, is that the inner journey, it doesn't matter. I could be somewhere else today and I'd still be me.
Yep.
I'm not determined by my outside world, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. And it is funny how the context plays such an important part in your self-identification. And potentially, I mean, certainly for myself, having recently just come out of the military, I had a wonderful opportunity to study for a year, and a big part of that year for me was working out, you know, what I wanted to be when I grew up, what I defined as, you know, happiness, whatever that is, and success. And when I was really critically looking at it, and this is the first time in 43 years I'd ever done that, I recognized things like status, things like identifying as a soldier, as a member of a unit, as a rank. They were big parts in my life. And I, when I thought about it, when I looked at it clinically, that wasn't something I was particularly happy with, that to be identifying like that. But subconsciously, I'd been doing that.
I think it's part of the survival mechanism. You know, I think that that's what I got from that deconstruction of the ego, is that the ego is just a survival mechanism. It's an evolution to keep us safe. We replay patterns that kept us safe in the past. You know, the bully will always be a bully because he got attention for being that. The sporto will always be the sporto because they got attention for doing that. So we're attention, we're not attention machines, we're energy. We need energy to survive, but it doesn't matter where the energy comes from. It can be good or bad, it's just a quantity.
Yeah.
Did you originally think that all people would do here is build a surfboard?
No, for me it was always that surfboards are what I love to do. I love to build surfboard, but that's not my purpose. That's not my job. My job is to help people and to be a mentor to a different way of life, you know. So when people come in the door, nobody gets asked what they do, because it doesn't matter to me. But that's a big paradigm shift for them, because normally most people come in and go, well, this is what I do, and this is where I work, and this is my car. And it was like, right, this is what we're doing. Bang, get to work. And it might be like Drew said, I've known him for over 2 years, and he goes, yeah, and he asked me the other day, because it just doesn't matter. I don't know if I answered your question then, Tim.
That's a good one. No, I think walking around, there's a lot of things in here that I think are indicative of a philosophy inside this workshop. You're sitting next to a Munga Barri photograph. There's a picture of an old world picture on the wall there. Upstairs, you've got Yoda. A Yoda doll sitting on one of the seats. There's a Mark Richards surfboard, not surprisingly. But then there's also a picture of the Last Supper.
Yeah.
How does all that come together into a philosophy that is applied in the workshop?
What's that Marianne Williamson pros that Nelson Mandela said, you know, where our job is to, it's something like our job is to shine, and it's not to shrink back, and that's to show other people that they can shine. So for me to live authentically and in my own truth, I think that gives other people the opportunity to say, well, if you can do it, I can do it.
And so can I use another word, community? You've previously talked about the community of surfers, what's happening on the beach and out the back of a break, and how that's changed.
Yep.
And maybe you having some role in that community. Can you talk there firstly?
So I think to talk about that first, the important thing for me is something that I live by, which is destination determines the journey. And so we're told in our modern day that it's all about the journey. You got to enjoy the journey. And to me, I just don't agree with that. To me, destination determines the journey. And so for me to set my destination from where I was headed, I had to change my journey. And once I changed my journey, then I had to learn to enjoy it. But the destination determined the journey. So a long-term part of Bodhi Tree was building a community of people who felt proud of the board they were riding. And a long-term part of that is that you go out into the water and something that's unique and unusual, and people start talking again. So back when I started surfing, it wasn't unusual to talk on the beach or to talk in the water or to talk in the car park and to swap boards. And unless you're in a clique, that doesn't happen anymore. But the guys who have a wooden board, it takes them 15, 20 minutes to get from the car park to the beach because someone will stop them and say, "Where'd you get that?" And I made it. And that reaffirmation of pride.
And it's funny because it's a material thing. It's a surfboard. But it's not like, you know, it's the most expensive, flashiest, you know, it's not a status symbol. It's actually a manifestation of a process of something you've done yourself. So it's a very different embodiment in that material item, isn't it?
And part of that, I suppose the advertising strategy is that we don't advertise to surfers. We advertise to people who love surfing. Because a surfer is, I'm a surfer. I know surfboards. I know this. I know that. I am, you know. No, I am a person. And I'm here to learn or to share or to grow or to be kind. So it's that I am is an important thing. When they come in here, I'm a builder. I'm a surfboard builder. Like I'm not what I thought I was. I'm not that identity. I'm this right now.
So you introduced us to Drew and him to you, and he talked about his journey in building a surfboard that originally he thought was just a surfboard. Where he came from, and where he got to in the process, two different places completely.
Yep.
Is that normal?
Yep.
So the people you see walking in the front door, how does the process change them?
I see the best in them. And I think that allows them to see the best in themselves, you know. It's not uncommon for me to say, I don't believe your story. When somebody says, I can't do this or I can't do that or I'm going to fuck this up, and it's like, I don't believe your story. This is how you do this next step. Do it like this. Hold the machine like this. Like it's, oh, you did it. Fucking well done, you know. This is next. This is how you do it. No.
Tim spoke about the amazing sort of artifacts that are around us as we're having this conversation. One that really struck me was a quote written on the wall in the next room saying that every great mistake is the start of a great design feature. And I love that for a whole bunch of reasons. The sort of the budding artist in me, you know, these things about happy accidents where you stuff something up and then it actually turns out to be your favourite part of a piece.
Very much so.
But it also talks to this idea about, well, what actually is right? What is success? And we go in with this idea of what we think our life or our surfboard or whatever is going to end up looking like. But as we stuff things up along the way, I think in hindsight, they're often the best bits. They're the best design features that we initially thought were mistakes.
I think that obviously our education system values the dude who gets the straight A's and fits in the boxes and stuff like that. But I think that's a really tight box to sit inside, you know, that those people will always be the ones that follow the rules.
Yeah.
But the rules aren't necessarily what creates reality. So Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey, he talks about first creation and second creation, and that the first creation is in your mind. You know, you got to sit back and dream it and believe it and visualize it and things like that. And that's the most important part, is the dreamer. The second part, which is the physical manifestation, is the easy part, because that's when you get your plebs to do the work, you know. But if you don't have that vision in the first place, you can't get the manifestation created.
And if you're not afraid of those mistakes, the failures, I mean...
And what I've found with the ex-service personnel is that you guys are trained to never make a mistake, that a mistake will cost a life. But that's not how normal civvies work, is it? You know, we're all blasé and shits and giggles and life's grey, it's not black and white. And I think that's one of the things that the ex-service personnel get out of it, is that, without giving away too many secrets, I design mistakes into the process. So you've got to make a mistake. So they get devastated, but in 5 minutes, that mistake's not going to matter.
Yeah.
And that mistake, like you say, could be the favourite part of the board.
Mm. Mm. So there's a community of people from all walks of life building more than a surfboard here.
Yep.
What do you learn from them?
It's patience. It's patience and compassion, and I learn about myself, because it's very easy to act like a tool when something goes wrong. You know, that it's easy to act like a dingbat or to react badly instead of act. And again, you know, that Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, where Viktor Frankl was like, in between stimulus and response is choice. So in here, it's slowing time down, that in between stimulus and response, my action instead of my reaction is what is best for them. So it's helping me to refine myself, you know, that emulation of a hero. So the person that I emulate is the person that I see myself as in the future.
The best version.
Yeah. And to be that best version, my destination has to change. I can't be who I was last week or last year. I have to be better then.
Mm. Yeah. You've also talked about a lot of people that come in here with baggage, midlife crisis, post-traumatic stress, some degree of depression or anxiety. How does the process assist that?
In psychological terms, they call it entrainment. But to me, in quantum physics, it's called sympathetic vibratory resonance. In basically, two opposing energies can't exist in the same place at the same time. So if things are opposing, they will polarize. And so we create an energy in here where you just get on with your job. Mm. And what that does is instill that confidence in people to be their best and to do their best at that moment, which polarizes all the things they can't do. So as they grow in that process, to me, things just seem to fall away. You know, every stage of this is challenging, and my job is to make it look as simple as possible. If I told people how difficult this was, I'd never get anyone walking through the door. So it's a super challenging process, and the implied ability is that, right, this is your job today, this is what you're doing, bang, holy shit, this is really hard. Keep going.
And this comes to that point we were having just before we turned the mics on, that Tim has, in separate fora, spoken about happiness being, you know, the result of overcoming a struggle. I mean, if it was easy to make a beautiful surfboard like the ones we're looking at in this workshop, then, you know, almost by definition, there'd be no satisfaction in it.
They'd lose value.
Yeah.
Sure.
And the kind of generation that we've been so fortunate to be part of, where we haven't had these epic existential struggles that maybe, you know, during World War II they had, in other parts of the world they're currently experiencing, we've kind of had it pretty easy, you know, bad days when the Wi-Fi goes out and we can't play Fortnite or whatever it might be. And although that has all the trappings of happiness, it's actually quite a hollow, miserable existence, and potentially that's why we're seeing so much mental health issues, depression, etc., etc., and maybe coming back to purposely building in struggle, building in that hero's journey, overcoming something is important.
And I think that probably goes back to that identity thing, is that, like you're saying, with success, is that when people you know, obviously just an overview and not a truth, but when people see success, they see, well, look how big my telly is, you know. Mm. Where to me it's like, look how big my programming device is, you know. Mm. look at how dumb I am. Is that those successes or that identity is created around those material possessions, but at any stage, like you say, the Wi-Fi could go out. So, oh shit, who am I?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we believe that happiness is an unobtainable goal. We also love the philosophy of Tim Jack Adams, which is the layers of happiness. You can put them on, they can come off. This is awesome, but we need a tangent. Let's have a little tangent on the performance of a wooden surfboard before we come back to more philosophy.
Were we getting a bit deep here, Tim?
Oh, no, it's great. I just need a moment.
So first and foremost, the boards are built to function. So that was the main criteria, is that every board in here works. They're designed to work. First and foremost, they're a functional board. Second is they're an art piece. And third, they're an heirloom. So we teach with an understanding, not knowledge. So most surfers will walk into a surf shop and they'll look at dimensions and displacement and stuff like that. But it's a fashion thing. It doesn't really matter. When you pick a board up, you know if it's going to work or not. Or some goose that really doesn't know how a surfboard works is going to sell you a board. So they're designed to surf. You know, we make fairly traditional boards with a bit more displacement. It's really up to the builder to look at their fin placement and their rail design, so how sharp the rails are, the rocker settings and things like that, which determines where they can surf it. But they're built to surf, like they're an absolute hoot.
But yeah, they weren't always that way. We spoke about mistakes before, and you confided in us that this beautiful board that I'm looking at the moment that you made for your boy surfs like a log.
And a lot of that was just the fact that it was a... not discrediting where I learned, but it was a woodworking course, you know. Right. It was 6 days to smash it out. It wasn't a surfboard building course. It was a woodworking course. Ah. Where we built a surfboard.
Yeah, okay.
So we've walked around and seen all of these boards. They're very unique, but just to create a picture on how the boards become unique, what do people do here to make things very personal for them, for their board to be very unique to them?
A lot of people will put personal artwork on it. They'll put the footprints of their kids on there, or we can fade out photos and put photos in there on rice paper and quotes. And like I say, a lot of the ex-service guys will put names of the people they've lost or things that mattered to them inside the boards. So it's a way of making it more than a board.
One of the ones that caught my eye was that little piece of Jarrah on the sort of tail of a board. And where was that from?
So that was from a guy's parents' house. Yeah. So it's making it. It really is tying in those elements. You know, people find shells from different parts of the world, like operculums and things like that, and sink them into the board, or medallions. Or. Yeah.
And the wood. I mean, out the front of the shop are these huge logs.
Yeah.
That you go and collect. Talk us through the wood. What type of wood is it? How has it worked from that huge log to a beautiful surfboard?
So the timber is called Paulownia tormentosa, which is Paulownia. In China, it's a native of China. They call it dragon wood or empress wood. When a girl is born, they plant a tree, and when she comes of age, they build a dowry box out of it. And when a boy comes of age, they use that as the first log to build his house. So it's pretty funky. World's fastest growing tree, technically a hardwood, but also said to be a grass. So it has like a bamboo feeder tube through the middle. Where I get it from, it was sustainably grown up in Jinjin. The business model of tree planting, the bum fell out of it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of trees just sitting there. So I go and collect the trees with a mate, bring them back here to dry out, and then take them to Clark Timber Solutions up in Gidgeganup, and we mill all the timber, and then everything gets machined in the shop ready to use. Yeah.
There's something about that process, and again, which is potentially lost from modern society. We get all this wooden stuff, and I reckon there's a parallel to the meat we get in a supermarket, you know.
Yeah.
It's often hard to draw the line back to the fact that this was once a tree or an animal, you know. Yeah. We're insulated from that part of it, which... is a really important part of understanding the process and I think the sustainability aspects as well.
So when I realised I wanted to build boards for the rest of my life, I didn't have a tool in my shed. So I had no woodworking experience. I had probably 6 months living in Kalgoorlie at high school, which was more about survival than woodworking. So my first workbench was 2 wheelie bins. And it was like, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do it properly and understand it. And, well, I could buy the timber, but that'd be no fun. So it was shits and giggles. And yeah. Like I say, the whole joke of Bodhi tree is that I just had to figure out a way to stay in the shed.
Well, there's no saying, I mean, there's not a complete, it's definitely a complete process.
Yeah.
Nothing missing except you literally felling the tree.
And occasionally, so in the past I have done that. So I'll glass the boards all the way, so from the tree to the sea. Mm. Yeah.
And the wood. You don't force the wood on people. People select the piece of wood or the pieces of wood.
So when somebody comes in to build a board, the timber that they get to choose from is whatever's next in the pile. So I'll grab the milled timber and I'll machine it and I'll get the best out of it and I'll put that on the table and that's what's there. I'll mill up some feature timber of Western Red Cedar and stuff like that, and then it's up to the builder to individually place those timbers and get the best out of it.
Mm. Yeah.
So from the very first day, from the very first moment, it's an ownership.
Mm.
Greg, we've touched on the process and what it means to people, but you were kind enough to share with us this morning some of the testimonials from people who have created a board through Bodhi Tree. And it struck me really clearly that in some cases this is life-changing. This is something that people have never been exposed to. A number of the testimonials talk about being in pretty dark places and this being a real catalyst to changing their life. That must be pretty satisfying.
I'm just doing my job. Like it's.
But you've chosen a job. You've said a couple of times that it's to help people. I mean.
Yeah.
Again, it almost sounds funny because we hear so many people pursuing material goals, the status that we spoke about before. The fact that you've chosen a job which is very selfless is pretty admirable.
My mum always says that when I was a kid, I used to do the right thing. Didn't matter what the consequences were, it was just I'd do the right thing. And my mates always said that you just did the right thing, you know. So to me, I don't know, what else am I going to do? Earn money and I don't know.
Well, I'm going to ask the question in a different way. What gives you fulfillment? Is it a surfboard that's been built?
To me, the thing that gives me fulfillment is being the best person I can to and following my dreams and my bliss so I can be an example to my son. That's that if I never wanted to get to a point where I said to him, follow your dreams, mate, and he said, well, what about you, Dad? Oh, shit. And so I want to blaze a trail and say, it doesn't matter how hard it is. You know, back to the follow your bliss thing is that it's not enjoyable. It's following your bliss is that destination determines the journey, is that every time that a tragedy or a hiccup or a setback comes back, I go, is that going to stop me getting to my destination? No. Well, how do I get around it?
So can we talk about the next stage of the journey?
Yes.
We're going beyond surfboards.
Yeah, So I'm going to keep Bodhi Tree Surfboards to build custom boards, but the whole workshop component of Bodhi Tree Surfboards is being converted into a non-for-profit business, mm-hmm. which is going to be called Connected By, and that's primarily to be used as a rehabilitation activity service provider, is what we've called it, for ex-service personnel, current service personnel and first responders, mm-hmm. plus the general public. But we'll also be incorporating things like yoga and jiu-jitsu and health and art, and basically creating a hub based on these principles where people come in and they're not what they do. They're here for a reason and a purpose, and again, just create more community. You know, that you leave a community and you to come into a community.
There's so much goodness in that. Tim and I and a number of others have been thinking a lot about resilience lately and what creates that, what makes human beings more stronger. And Viktor Frankl, you mentioned before, I mean, geez, talk about resilience to come out of that sort of concentration camp experience and then write Man's Search for Meaning and reflect very positively on it. But a number of those aspects, just in your title, that idea of connected by, it resonates with these concepts of tribe, of, you know, belonging to something bigger, that particularly that demographic you spoke of, ex-service personnel, first responders, doing what is at times a really hard job, but supported in this tribe. And yep. Then all of a sudden, at some point, for whatever reason, you get spat out the other end. And that aspect of your resilience, that connectedness, the tribe, is missing. And you can really fall into a heap, as unfortunately most of us have seen.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of continuing that idea of connection, albeit through a different means.
And I think the big thing for me is that a tribe is part of a community, but they're a separated part of the community. Mm. You know, you guys had a tribe because it was a specialized job that you had to do, but you're not outside of the community. It's reintegrating that tribe into community. You know, I'm a bit anti-tribe. I'm very pro-community.
Mm.
That separation by status or
yeah.
employment is a pretty damaging thing, I think.
I definitely think it can be. Certainly this, like Tafjell's social identity theory, where it says we define an in-group and an out-group. And I think that is an important component of a tribe, you know, all the way back in anthropological, you know, context. We needed to see who was goodies and baddies. But when it's that differentiation is made in a discriminatory or an exclusionary fashion,
yeah.
that can be really toxic. I fully agree. It doesn't have to be, though. We can be a tribe as part of a community. And
exactly.
I reckon that's a beautiful. I've never thought of it like that, but it's a beautiful way of putting it.
Mm. Okay. So connected by, that's the future. How would you define success looking forward? How would you define success in connected by?
I think it's just being recognised as a safe place to go, you know, a safe haven for people. To me, success, the next thing on my horizon is helping Classroom of Hope to build schools in developing countries. So using sponsorship and charitable donations to connected by, a percentage of that will obviously partially or fully fund first responders and ex-service personnel and disenfranchised people all over the place. But a percentage will go to educating kids and building schools and stuff like that. Yeah, just to be a good dad, that's success to me. Mm-hmm. Like, this is all part and parcel of living, you know. I had to make a wage and pay taxes, so why do a shitty job?
And if you had the ear of the world and you could give the world one piece of advice, what would that be?
I think acceptance. And that doesn't mean laying down into submission. Mm. It could be acceptance that you don't accept something, or acceptance that you don't agree with something. But I think acceptance is the thing that creates the difference between, you know, in between stimulus and response. If the stimulus happens and you accept it, you can choose response, which can be action. And I think that the most important action from acceptance is that love is the answer, you know, is that it's compassion and caring and a kind word can make the difference to somebody's world. Yeah. Mm.
So we draw inspiration from a Rudyard Kipling poem called If. There's a great component of the poem that I'd like to read you and get your reflections on. Just bear with me. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools.
Fantastic. I think it's that tempering, you know. I think it's the most important thing is getting smashed and getting back up. You know, it's not in Buddhism and meditation and stuff like that. The practice isn't sitting and meditating. It's coming back to meditation when you fall off the wagon, or it's that getting back up. And again, destination determines the journey. Is that if all those things get reflected so clearly, are those things going to stop me getting to my destination? And if the answer is no, well, keep plodding along. And if it's yes, destination determines the journey. Where's the next goal?
And in that light, those ideas of triumph and disaster both being imposters, I mean, it resonates so strongly, doesn't it? Because those are external perspectives, success and failure. But if you're heading on that path and you're putting one foot in front of the other, that's a win.
Yeah, and again, that follow your bliss, you know, is that it's not pleasant, is that there's more than 5 days of the week that I wake up and go, oh, fuck, I have to do it again. But the destination is more important than that fleeting thought, that imposter. Because that's the ego going, you didn't survive like this, you haven't survived like this in the past by doing things that are not accepted or not understood. Well, one of my aphorisms was, fuck you thoughts, I've got a dream to build. because I couldn't get on top of my thoughts. I was like, fuck you thoughts, I've got a dream to build.
So what's it cost to build more than a surfboard?
So anything from basically 6 to 8 foot is $1,600 plus GST. And that's a glass board, so walk in, walk out with the board. There's no time frame. So we get a lot of FIFO workers and military crew that will come in when they can, and different business people. And then from there we go up to a 10.5 foot paddle board, which is about $3,500.
And how do people find out a bit more about you, Greg, and Bodhi Tree and the future in Connected By?
Hopefully you can't find out too much about me. Bodhi Tree is www.bodhitreesurf.com.au, and it's BODHITRESURF, and that at Bodhi Tree Surf on Instagram and Facebook.
That's awesome.
Before we leave Bodhi Tree, why the title? Why the name Bodhi Tree?
So Bodhi Tree was the tree that Buddha sat under when he reached enlightenment. So Bodhi means wisdom or enlightenment and all those things. So my son's name is Jara. I had no interest in woodworking before he was born. His mum basically said his name's Jara, and it was like, well, that fits, you know. So it was trying to tie in a tree into the surfboard thing, and my leaving the corporate world was my enlightenment.
Yeah. And of course, for people of our generation, the Patrick Swayze character in Point Blank.
That's right.
That's got to be the boat's advert. Yeah, that's got to be a link in there somewhere,
true.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's Bodhi. They call him the Bodhisattva. He's a modern savage. He's a real searcher.
What's he searching for?
The ride. The ultimate ride. Guy's even crazier than you, Johnny.
Look, Greg, that's magic. We'll certainly, and when I say we, I mean Tim, because he's going to do the very extensive show notes for this one with all the references and literature that you've dropped. But we'll put all those links in our show notes so people can find more about you. And we will definitely stay in touch. We'll keep our listeners up to date with how Connected By develops and
fantastic.
The exciting and, as I said before, very selfless things that you're doing from here. Thank you, mate. Thank
Absolute
you very much.
Pleasure. Thanks so much, guys.
Fast enough. One of them's flowing, not far enough. One of them's crying for what has made it sad. One of them's dying from what it never ever ever had. I'm too full.
counting the days, wishing for leaving, what it's like to be free, dreaming of sunshine. Wishing for leaving, what it's like to be free, dreaming of sunshine.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.